Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a radioactive isotope used for cancer screenings could soon be produced in Janesville. We'll learn about the project that would be the only one of its kind in North America. First, Governor Walker says he wants to prop up the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, to bring down the cost of health insurance. It's a surprising move for Walker, who's long been a critic of the health care law. He'll ask for $200 million in state and federal money to stabilize Wisconsin's Affordable Care Act market. The governor said the move is necessary because Washington, quote, failed to act, end quote, on repealing and replacing the health care law. Phil Rocco is the co-author of a book on the healthcare debate. It's called Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He's also an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Rob.
Before we get into the politics behind this, Phil, let's look at what the governor is getting on board with here. These are some ideas that I understand some Democratic state lawmakers had done. First of all, what do we mean by stepping in, using money to stabilize the healthcare marketplace?
Well, there are two big things we talk about when we think about stability. When we think about stability, we think about the things that make it enticing for insurers to stay in the state and offer coverage. And the other part of stability is thinking about how able are people to actually get coverage that takes care of their needs. And so what Walker is proposing on the one hand is to create a fund for reinsurance. And reinsurance is basically payments to insurers that help them make up part of the cost for covering people. And in other states like Minnesota, where these reinsurance programs have been implemented, there's been a huge drop in premiums. The other part of it is putting into law protections for people with pre-existing conditions, actually writing that into state law. And so that's where Walker is proposing calling on the Senate to take action on a bill that was brought up by a Democratic state representative named Daniel Reamer that prohibits lifetime and annual limits on health insurance plans.
And these are issues that had come up in the national debate over whether to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Are we now seeing a lot of states kind of taking their own measures, given that nothing happened at the federal level?
Well, if you think about it, the Affordable Care Act for years was for Republicans, politically toxic to support, right? It was a bill that was really associated with the Democratic Party. And so there was this great kind of outpouring of criticism and backlash. But as action has sort of taken place at the federal level, I think one thing Republicans have realized is that proposing to gut some of the protections that are really popular in this law is also kind of politically toxic. And I think one thing you're seeing at the state level is Republican governors like Walker trying to thread this needle where you're both maintaining this criticism of the ACA, but also saying, you know, what is the opportunity I have here to sort of step in and do something that's politically feasible. And so I think Walker is kind of one governor that's doing this, but there are other governors, I think, Matt Bevin in Kentucky, that are kind of packaging together, you know, some support for different parts of the ACA, but then advancing more conservative initiatives like putting a work requirement into Medicaid for people who are so-called able-bodied Medicaid. And so I think we'll see sort of attempts by governors to, you know, sort of maintain their conservative bona fides, but at the same time try to take advantage of an opportunity to do something politically popular.
It's an election year, but the governor is saying, hey, this is a bipartisan issue or a nonpartisan issue even. There's room for cooperation between Democrats and Republicans. Do you expect to see that kind of cooperation?
Well, I think it's one of these situations where the substance of the policy is really going to matter, right? And so, you know, while it's important for, you know, the state to take steps to make sure that insurers have some incentive to stay in the market, right? Something you might see Democrats say is, well, that's not necessarily, enough, right? What are the real details of the plan? To what extent is it actually going to make insurance more affordable for people who qualify for premium tax credits? What is the sort of content of the plan that Walker is looking for here? And you might see sort of new red lines start to emerge, right? Democrats might push for the governor's plan to include limits on substandard plans that were allowed by the Trump administration when it sort of passed and created a new executive order that allowed association health plans to be sold, and those plans have kind of weaker benefits than other ACA plans. So you might see Democrats kind of step in and kind of say, this is the kind of the price of our cooperation.
Talking to Phil Rocco, professor of assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, looking at what Governor Walker's been saying about the Affordable Care Act, efforts to prop it up a little bit here in Wisconsin. And Phil, when people think of the Affordable Care Act, I think they think of the marketplace. That's just part of the Affordable Care Act. But can you talk about what's been happening with marketplace premiums here in Wisconsin?
Right. So marketplace premiums in Wisconsin have increased, I think, pretty substantially in recent years, in part because there's been some lack of desire on the part of some insurers to participate in the marketplace. And another thing that can, you know, in some states add to the sort of premiums is that we, because we the state did not take the Medicaid expansion, we have a slightly sicker risk pool in the individual marketplace than we might otherwise have if people who would otherwise qualify for coverage under the Medicaid expansion would have taken that. And so, you know, there's been this overall trend towards increasing premiums across the country, and I think Wisconsin is you know, part of that story.
As you mentioned earlier, the other big thing the governor's talking about is protections for people with pre-existing conditions to make sure they don't lose health coverage. As I understand it, that's already part of the Affordable Care Act. Why make a separate state law?
Well, I think that you know, part of the sort of challenge that Republicans like Scott Walker face is sort of demonstrating their commitment to protecting people with pre-existing conditions, right? And they've sort of lost the opportunity to do that. Republicans have sort of lost the opportunity to do that at the federal level. Most of the bills that were coming out of Congress or that were proposed and were potentially going to pass really didn't include a lot of those protections, and I think we're seen as some sort of violation or attempted violation of something that people think of as being a popular sort of right that the ACA created. And so I think you might start to see things like this enshrined in state law, especially if states undertake waivers under the ACA Section 1332 provision that, and those waivers really allow states to exempt themselves from a variety of the ACA's kind of regulatory requirements. And so, especially if it seems as if there aren't going to be any guardrails for, you know, what states can sort of experiment with in that waiver program, you might see some desire, especially even on the part of Republican governors, to kind of say, we have guardrails in our state.
And I want to get into one more part of what the governor's talking about, continuing the state's drug discount program for people over 65 called Senior Care. Can you talk about that?
So Walker, in addition to putting these ACA provisions on the table, is sort of packaging them, packaging this together with another provision to sort of extend for a longer period of time this waiver program called Senior Care. And again, I think the rationale here is while these parts of stabilizing various parts of the ACA is politically popular, I think one thing that Walker is kind of hoping to do here is kind of sweeten the pot. And in part, that is the senior care plan is something that affects a different population than the ACA affects. And I think that that might be some pitch to, you know, demonstrating some commitment to lowering the cost of care for seniors. And this plan costs covers about $30 a year plus deductibles and copays and other expenses for about 92,000 seniors in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there for now. Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Phil Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's co-author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He joined us to look at Governor Walker's plan to shore up the Affordable Care Act to stabilize the state's health insurance market, among other things. Right now, the loss of Janesville's General Motors plant in 2008 left a void in the area's economy that's still felt today. But a new type of factory could be coming to Rock County, one that produces a radioactive isotope. It's called molybdenum-99. The isotope is used to screen for different types of cancers, but its supply is always in question. A production facility in Janesville would be the only one of its kind in North America. Sarah Varney is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's been reporting on this. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about molybdenum-99, not a household word, definitely. What is it used for?
So nuclear medicine imaging basically runs on what's called Moly-99, and it's this radioisotope. It's produced by nuclear fission by taking enriched uranium, and it decays incredibly rapidly. So within just a couple of days, the isotope is practically worthless. So it's used for bone cancer scans. It's used for cardiac stress tests. It's used for breast cancer screening. It is used in, you know, upwards of 90% of all nuclear medicine imaging runs entirely on this Moly-99.
And it's not produced currently anywhere on our continent, is that right?
It is not. It's not produced anywhere in North America. It's produced primarily at these six government-owned nuclear reactors. Most of them are in Europe. There's one in South Africa and one in Australia. And the reactors are, you know, primarily built during the Eisenhower administration. So they're quite old and quite rickety. They're always requiring upgrades. There is a new reactor in South Africa, but this one is currently offline, actually. So it's, once again, the Moly-99 shortage is starting to concern a lot of nuclear medicine departments around the country.
So it's coming from around the world. It's an unstable supply. It's an unstable isotope, so it has to get to from production to use pretty quickly. So if I am someone working in a hospital, I'm doing these kind of tests with this molybdenum-99, do I know if it's going to be available for my screening that I'm doing tomorrow?
No, not necessarily. It's actually, I even talked to, you know, the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, one of the premier cancer clinics in the country, and you'd think that they would just have a stable supply of this. And it's really, you know, night after night, these nuclear pharmacists are looking at their supply to figure out whether or not they're going to have enough to distribute to the hospitals. One of the people that I interviewed described this like running through the desert with an ice cream cone. So there's a long story that I did for the New York Times, about 2,500 words or so. So if people want to read more about it, they can read it there. But essentially, once they make this stuff in the nuclear reactors in either Europe or South Africa or Australia, it gets processed, goes through a number of different stages, and it gets put on actual commercial airline flights. In some cases, you know, the pilots say, I don't want to fly with this stuff on my plane. Or in other cases, there was one instance where it was going through Dubai and there was a huge fog bank that came in, so the planes couldn't take off, so the stuff just decayed and became worthless. Then there's other times when the reactors themselves, I mentioned, are shut down because there's a lightning strike, or in the case of South Africa, there was one time when a baboon got into the reactor hall and they had to shut the thing down. So this is very much a catch-as-catch-can supply chain, and so there's been this big impetus to try and create homegrown Moly-99. And there was a law signed by President Obama in 2013 that really encouraged radioisotope development in the United States. So there are hundreds of millions of dollars of grants that have been awarded by the NNSA, by the federal government, to try and encourage companies to go into this. You can imagine it takes a lot of money to build one of these things. The plant in Janesville is estimated at about $100 million. And when all is said and done, price tag will be much more than that.
Talking to Sarah Varney from Kaiser Health News about an effort to create this hard-to-produce, hard-to-get radioactive isotope, molybdenum-99, that's used in cancer screenings, and why the road appears to be leading to Janesville, Wisconsin, to produce it. And Sarah, let's take it to Janesville. Why are we looking at, just down the street from a lot of us in Wisconsin to produce this key isotope?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that the president of of SHINE, as it's called, is from or went to school in Madison, Wisconsin. So there's a lot of nuclear engineers, as it turns out, in Madison who went to the university there. And he had a lab, a development lab, that was based just outside of Madison. So when he was looking to figure out where he was going to build this facility, he started looking at a number of different cities in Wisconsin, as well as some other states. But the this is 2009-2010 or so, and as you remember, Janesville was still reeling from the closure of the GM plant, and its economic development team was very aggressively pursuing economic development projects. So they got wind of what was happening with SHINE, and so they offered SHINE a very lucrative deal. They offered them this huge swath of land just south of the city in this what is now a cornfield, basically. They offered to put lots of electricity and other kinds of utilities out to the site, and they also offered them some loans, which would be forgivable if SHINE somehow was unable to went belly up, essentially, in the process.
This is not.
There's also, I should say, another one of these radioisotope production facilities in Beloit, so also in Rock County, called North Star Medical Radioisotopes. Now, they're not building a nuclear accelerator. They're trying to make Moly 99 in a way that doesn't involve uranium. So they are also have a facility. So it is quite strange that in Rock County, Wisconsin, you have basically two of the three companies that are trying to get control of this Moly 99 market here in the United States.
Can you talk about some of the challenges of doing this? Because this isn't the kind of startup you can just slap together in your garage. This is, radioactive isotopes. There are obviously regulations for national security reasons, among others. What goes into making this happen?
Well, you can imagine this is incredibly complex, right? So there is a facility in Tennessee where a lot of the highly enriched uranium, actually most of the highly enriched uranium in the United States, is stored. The United States then ships that uranium overseas to France primarily, to the government facility in France. They then essentially truck this stuff, this highly enriched uranium, which terrorists prize this highly enriched uranium because they can use it to make dirty bombs. So they truck it to these nuclear reactors around Europe, and then it has to get processed. And when you essentially blast this highly enriched uranium, it creates this atomic alphabet soup. And so then they go in and they fish out the Moly 99. That then gets processed and gets sent back to the United States, as I mentioned, on these commercial jets. And then it gets processed again into this imaging agent called technetium 99. Once it's turned into technetium, it only has about 6 hours before it decays so rapidly that it becomes worthless. So it's quite a complex supply chain, and right now it's obviously going across the globe. And the idea is to try and create some sort of local source for Moly 99. Some companies are looking at trying to do it without highly enriched uranium. Some are trying to do it without uranium at all. But the question is, right now this stuff does not make a ton of money. So in order to attract investors into this market, it's been quite difficult for some of these companies.
So if these plants in Beloit and Janesville end up coming online, and that's a big if, it's not a sure thing, it sounds like, what would the timeline be?
Well, the timeline has really shifted. So, I mean, SHINE originally in some of the initial documents had already predicted that they would be up and running right now. Its CEO, Greg Pfeiffer, recently said that they would be in full commercial production sometime in 2020. They did break ground last August on this prototype facility in Janesville, and SHINE is saying that it'll be open later this year. And I think the plan is that they want to be able to show potential investors that its nuclear accelerator technology works. So they've built these prototypes that are actually in the lab up in Monona, and it's quite impressive. And you walk in there and you have to wear, it's not the right word, but it's basically like a Geiger counter that essentially tells you you're not being blasted with nuclear radiation. And there are these magical devices that look like these giant purple lightsabers. And that's essentially what they're going to build in this prototype facility, even larger versions of that in this prototype facility.
And as for what's at stake, I think you wrote that we in the United States are the biggest consumers of this molybdenum-99 in cancer screenings.
We are. So it's, and it's not just cancer screenings, I should say. I mean, one of the biggest uses for this are cardiac stress tests. So if you think you've had a heart attack or your doctor thinks you've had a heart attack, they'll send you to a nuclear medicine medicine imaging department, and you'll get you'll most definitely be injected with technetium-99, and that'll show whether or not there's some sort of blockage in your heart. As I mentioned, it also bone scans is another primary use of this. But there's about 50,000 Americans each day that depend on technetium-99 or moly-99. So we are the largest consumers of this in the world.
Are there other comparable products or methods of doing the same thing that this isotope is used for?
There are other that this isotope is used for. Not that this isotope is used for. There's other ways in which, you know, there are other ways to do a cardiac stress test. There's other ways to detect whether or not there's cancer in your bones or in a breast. And when there have been worldwide shortages of moly-99, some of these nuclear medicine departments have switched over to different technologies. One of them is called positron emission tomography, PET. Much more widespread in the market now, but it is still a quite expensive procedure, and Medicare doesn't approve of it for certain types of scans, and it tends to be much more expensive. So I think there's a good question whether or not, you know, if they can really stabilize the moly-99 market, that will probably stave off the further encroachment of some of these other technologies. But if they can't, you know, it could be that some of these more expensive technologies ends up taking over, and overall the cost of nuclear medicine imaging goes up.
And for people working in nuclear medicine, do they feel a sense of urgency and maybe hope that there could be a domestic, more or less local supply?
I think that they, you know, they're so used to kind of this crazy supply chain where they're not really sure every day whether or not they're going to have enough that I think they become somewhat inured to it. So I don't get the sense that within nuclear medicine imaging there's a real concern necessarily or a sense of urgency. I mean, I think that from the government's perspective, you know, they really want to secure this highly enriched uranium. They don't want to be shipping it overseas, but they are fully aware that many of these nuclear medicine imaging departments could not operate if they didn't continue to ship this stuff. So I think a lot of the concerns come more from, you know, certainly stabilizing the supply chain, but also really more from, you know, concern that terrorists are going to get their hands on some of the stuff while it's in motion.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
That's Sarah Varney from Kaiser Health News. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network. First, Wisconsin is heading into a midterm election year with a state government that's deeply divided. A lot of political observers have seen polarization getting worse over the years, and our next guest says it is a problem, but there are steps we could take to make things at least a little less partisan. Todd Berry recently retired after nearly 25 years as president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. His recent editorial for the State Journal is called How to Fix Wisconsin's Hyper-Partisan State Government. Todd, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me again.
So, Todd, you're saying hyper-partisan, but it wasn't always that way. How did you see this change over time?
Well, you know, I started watching state government in the early 70s, and even then, it was starting to change. The people were running for the legislature saying that I will be a full-time legislator and I will be there to serve you full-time. And as things unrolled from there, and part of it is national political trends too, but I do think that the combination of the nation's politics and Wisconsin's legislature evolving have, in the last 10 to 20 years, made it a fairly unkind place.
And you've, in your piece, you really point toward that idea of the full-time legislator. It's not a part-time gig. You see that as a big driver of partisanship. Why is that?
Yeah.
It seems like a structural thing that shouldn't make that much difference.
Well, and that's really what motivated this comment, is that I tend to think about behavior as there are structural things that if you push lever B or pull button A or whatever you do, that certain things happen. And I think the way we've set things up result in what we've got. If you are a full-time legislator that relies on the job for your means of survival, the state benefits are obviously good. You get those. It's not a great living, but it's a decent living, your whole psychology changes because you don't serve on a city council or a school board or a county board because you want to have a political career or you want to keep a job. That's not true with a lot of the legislature. I'm not saying all legislators are like that by any means, but that has become more common. And when that happens, any kind of real advanced planning or strategic thinking about the state's problems tends to stop to a large degree. And the power tends to really gravitate, I think, to the party leaders who control committee appointments and chairmanships and bill scheduling and money and can even arrange primaries for people. And so it's really become much more tribal, much more divided, and the power is very concentrated. I don't think when people run for the legislature, they think that they are going to be essentially as controlled from the top as they are.
And you compare us to other states. There are some other states with full-time legislatures. Wisconsin is kind of different than most of the rest of them.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the research, 10 to 12 states tend to have what are called professional career legislatures. And when you look at the states, Illinois, New York, California, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, if I recall. Having been in the financial and fiscal and economic world for the last 25 years, that list became very familiar to me because what states have late budgets, often have deficit crises, have financial statements that are in the red, and on and on. And Wisconsin fits right into that group, even though we are much geographically smaller than a California and less populous than an Illinois.
Talking to Todd Berry, formerly of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, just retired there, talking about partisanship in Wisconsin state government, what drives it, and possible solutions. Full-time legislature, one of, but not the only cause, as you see it. Also, the way we draw legislative districts and the way we hold our primaries, you see as parts of the problem.
Elections, you know, both parties are very guilty on the redistricting score. When they get a chance, both Democrats and Republicans in this state, when they've had total power, have grabbed it and gerrymandered the state. The Democrats did so in the 80s, and that benefited them for decades. The Republicans did it more recently, and they have benefited. What compounds that, I think, is that the great La Follette legacy of the primary, which was supposed to take power away from the bosses, is actually sort of having the opposite effect, because low turnout primaries in August in districts that tend to be gerrymandered mean in places like Dane or Milwaukee County, you move far left to appeal to a small primary electorate. And the same in a Waukesha or an Ozaukee or a Washington County. You move to the right. So what happens if you look at the last election in 2016, over half of the Wisconsin legislature was reelected before November. So what accountability is there to voters when they don't have any choice?
And when these legislators are elected, so if you're in that liberal county, you're going to win, and you're going to elect the most liberal you can find, and vice versa, as you're saying, in a Republican conservative county. So all of a sudden, you've got the people as far to the left over here, as far to the right over here.
Exactly.
And they show up to meet together. Are they going to compromise?
Well, I mean, who are they responsive to? They're responsive to their electors. Who are their electors? Their low turnout August primary voters, which, you know, it may be 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 votes that elect them, when in a typical assembly race in a general election, maybe there are 18,000, 20,000, 22,000 votes cast. So the primary voter tends to be more extreme, more ideological, more single issue, and that goes on both sides of the aisle.
And you write that bringing it all together in a way, okay, I got elected, I show up, still, I want to try to compromise with the other party. I want to be a lone wolf. Well, you mentioned that party leadership with control in the assembly or Senate. oh, well, okay, that's fine. You're not on a committee. Or if I'm really ticked off, you will run a primary and find somebody further to the right or left than
yeah,
you.
Yeah, exactly. And although this hasn't happened recently, both parties have more or less arranged primaries for rebels in the last decade or so to try to punish incumbents that didn't behave.
Well, that's a lot of problems. There's enough problems for us to tackle in the next 17 minutes or so. Let's get to solutions. Is it realistic to think we could go back to a part-time legislature now?
Yeah. Well, a lot of other states, obviously, that are Wisconsin size and population are doing it.
But going back to it or just
well,
to avoid state with it?
There's the hitch. I should say, by the way, that these are strictly my opinions. They don't reflect any organization or so forth. I'm retired.
Speaking of lone wolves.
Yeah,
that's
I'm,
you
yeah, I'm not even a lame duck. I'm a dead duck. But when you look at the dynamic, there's no incentive for these people to compromise. They answer to a very narrow electorate, and the result is dysfunction. And we're seeing this in states like Wisconsin. Can we go back? Tough, because in a sense, the fox is in the chicken coop. I mean, there's a reason why when Democrats were in power in the late 2000s, they didn't want to change the redistricting law because they thought they were going to take advantage. There's a reason why Republicans don't want to change it now because they're benefiting from it. So it's hard to get the people that benefit from the system to change the system. That's not to say one can't come up with a lot of ideas to be discussed, and of course I did that in that column.
We're talking to Todd Barry, former president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, speaking for himself now, talking about how to make state government more bipartisan, lower the polarization in the state. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you seen what Todd is seeing? Wisconsin getting more polarized, more divided over the years, especially in its state government. Why do you think that is? What could change it? And what do you think about some of his specific ideas going back to making being a legislator a part-time job? How about to changing redistricting in Wisconsin? And maybe how about nonpartisan primaries? That's another idea he throws out there. We'll get into that in a minute. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with Todd Barry. He retired this year as president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He's sharing his ideas now on making state government more bipartisan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen Wisconsin politics get more divided over the years? Why do you think it's happened? And what do you think about ideas like going back to a part-time legislature, to changing the way we draw our voting maps, our district maps in Wisconsin? And how about changing the way we do primaries? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. And Todd, let's get into that idea I was just mentioning. Some states have done this, changing the way we do primaries. So there's not a Republican primary and a Democratic primary. Do I have that right?
Right. Some call it a jungle primary, and Washington State has it. I believe California has it now. Everybody runs, and regardless of party, the top two vote getters are elected. I think the beauty of that in a lot of the districts in Wisconsin, which by the virtue of where people choose to live are going to tend to be one-party districts, is at least you give voters a choice in a Republican, heavily Republican district among two Republicans in November or two Democrats in a Democratic district in November. I should add, though, that I don't think redistricting or primary changes are enough. I think there's a lot of other things we can do. I think more opportunity for third-party, independent kind of candidates would be a good thing. And frankly, the Democrats and Republicans in this state have written state election law essentially to create a duopoly, if you will, that protects them. other things that interest me, Illinois for many years had multi-member legislative districts, and they had something called bullet voting, and I don't want to go into the details, but the long and the short of it is, one, by the way one organized one's candidacy, could conceivably elect a Democrat out of Madison, or out of Waukesha County, or a Republican out of Madison, and so it tended to diversify the two parties within the legislature. Probably the most radical idea I threw out there, and people just, they almost grimace at this when I suggest it, but I think there's logic to it, and that is maybe we need one house of the legislature to be bigger. Maybe the assembly should be three times the size it is now. Pay them less, have to spread the staff out less, but what are the benefits of that? Well, first of all, it doesn't cost as much to campaign. You can be a legislator and campaign without having to give up a full-time job. Another particular appealing aspect of this to me is, what if special interest groups want to come in and buy lots of television time to try to influence a legislative race? Well, if there are suddenly 15 or 20 assembly districts around Madison, it's just, it's not efficient. And it also makes it harder, I think, for interest groups to attack candidates, because you're more likely to be known by your constituents, and so impersonal blind attacks aren't going to have as much effect. So anyway, those are a few other things that I was throwing out as well.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in Cudahy. Lou, hi. Lou, are you there? We don't have Lou. The phones are being a little weird, I think. I wanted to bring a headline up in the news today, Todd. A ruling, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court struck down their redistricting map over there. There are other challenges going around the country, including Wisconsin's in the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court now. Are you hoping for changes in the courts?
Well, I think we tend to look for change in courts too much and as a last resort. It should be, and I should say, and I'm not an attorney, that courts are really reluctant to get into legislative matters like this. So who knows what the U.S. Supreme Court will decide in the case that involves Wisconsin and some other states. To go to some more kind of Iowa bipartisan, nonpartisan kind of system would be good. The Republican majority in the legislature could do it tomorrow if they wanted. But I don't think it's the panacea. I think you have to do things with primaries, with election law, thinking about how the legislative houses are structured. You've really got to go in and try to change the structural incentives to get different results.
Let's try another caller, Jeff in Richland. Is that Richland Center? Jeff, hi.
Yeah, I live in Richland County. What I love, Mr. Berry, and I don't know if you do, but this whole notion of that politicians are these honorable golfers who will call their own fouls, and we let them make their own rules, and then they adjudicate whether they follow them or not. But what I would like to see, and have advocated for a while, is actually let's eliminate the state Senate and just have our assembly people, and they can all conduct their business right out on the floor where we can see what's going on, instead of these secret late night meetings they have between the two bodies, and all of a sudden you end up with this strange, you know, transformation of a bill that includes all kinds of weird stuff, and you have no idea who put it in there and who's behind all this.
Jeff, thanks for the call, and I think talking in part about the Joint Finance Committee between the two houses of the legislature.
Yeah. Well, and you get that kind of tribal secrecy because you have very tight party discipline and leadership control. I have had discussions like this with people. One gentleman I can think of in northern Wisconsin who's a Nebraska native and loves the nonpartisan unicameral Nebraska legislature. I have mixed feelings about that. I sometimes think that the problem with the Senate in Wisconsin, to be somewhat tongue-in-cheek, is it's the place assembly people go to die. And by that, I mean you just continue the full-time political career by moving from the Assembly to the Senate. And the two bodies are too much alike. And so what I suggested for the Senate is to keep it, but maybe it should be different. Maybe it should be, maybe it's smaller, I don't know. Maybe it is nonpartisan. Maybe it's elected in the spring. Maybe that it has, senators have 1 8- or 10-year term. And so it changes the chemistry a little bit between the houses. Sometimes there's advantage, to, I think, to having two houses. They can correct the mistakes of the other and sometimes check the excesses of the other. So, I mean, there's some reason for that.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Todd Barry about what he sees as causing polarization in Wisconsin politics and a lot of ideas to fix it. Back to your calls now. Alex is with us in Green Bay. Alex, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I think this was briefly alluded to before, but I really have strong feelings on the amount of money that's dumped into our elections over the last, at least for me, 10 years that I really kind of look at it. And I know there's been some legal battles on this, but, you know, I just feel like it's really hard to have fair elections when you have large corporations and really large donors putting so much money to sway our elections up, both sides, to be honest.
Alex, thanks. Campaign spending, Todd.
Yeah. Well, I can't think about that and decide whether it's a symptom or the disease. Obviously, I mean, what I suggested in having a much larger state assembly was let's not get into the whole legal debate over who's a person and what's free speech and not. I understand there's very strong feelings on both sides of that. But the approach I took was, well, how do you essentially take away their influence without getting into legal battles? You make it ineffective for their money to be spent.
Thanks a lot for the call, Alex. Time for one more. Gil is with us in Madison. Gil, hi.
Hi. What I'd like to suggest is that we get away from all this outside money coming in, trying to determine who should be our representative in government. And I would like to see a law that says only Wisconsin residents can contribute to Wisconsin candidates.
Interesting. I don't know if that might have a hard time passing legal muster.
Well, that may be the problem, too. And then, I mean, if you take that logic down the path a little more, then maybe you should say that you can only contribute to candidates that live in your district. Well, you know, what do you do if you live in a place like Watertown that is literally in two counties, or River Falls or whatever? So, I mean, you start to tinker with this stuff and, you know, the prescription sounds good. But again, I'm trying to think of ways, creative ways to blunt the effect of the money.
So briefly, Todd, as you said, both parties have a disincentive to do most of the things you're talking about. This isn't necessarily the kind of stuff that people get fired up about, the procedural mm-hmm. type thing. Do you see anybody driving changes like this?
Probably not. I think there are a couple ways that it could happen. I've always believed that legislators are hyper-responsive, believe it or not, to constituents, and that if you have 25 or 30 people in a legislative district who really want to work hard, they can probably turn out an incumbent, regardless of the party leadings of the district even. Another option is, you know, essentially you turn the governor's race into a referendum, and one of the gubernatorial candidates said, I'm running because I'm going to do A, B, C. Since we don't have initiative and referendum, that's the only way you can have a statewide vote on it.
We'll leave it there for now. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Todd Barry. He recently retired as president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He's speaking for himself here. He was with us to share his ideas on reducing the partisan divide in Wisconsin's government. He's written about that. A piece appeared in the Wisconsin State Journal sharing some of his thoughts about the causes of the partisan divide in Wisconsin and possible solutions. You can still share your thoughts, by the way. What do you think would make politics less polarized in the state? What do you think of Todd's ideas? You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. The Screen Actors Guild Awards were announced last night, and the Oscars, they're not too far off. Now, those are for things like the best movies, but what about the worst? The Golden Raspberry nominees for Worst Picture of 2017 were just announced. They are Baywatch, The Emoji Movie, 50 Shades Darker, The Mummy, and Transformers The Last Knight. Chris Molina is in the studio with us now, producer, to talk about what to do when you're seeing a bad movie. Chris, you're more willing to walk than you used to be.
I thought you were going to say I'm a bad movie aficionado, which is kind of true.
No, bad snack aficionado.
Well, there's that. But I mean, if you're going to start a movie now, let's say you sit down, you start watching, I don't know, The Emoji Movie, and 10 minutes into it, you're not into it. It is not worth finishing that movie. However, if it's a movie where you know it's just going to be campy, it's just going to be cheesy, and that's the entertainment value, then you stick with it.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember the last time I went and saw a bad movie in a theater, and I think what I'm doing is I'm doing a better job of pre-screening. I have walked out of movies in my life. It's rare. I don't think I'd go to a movie that had that risk level.
I think you're absolutely right, and I also think, you know, movies are crazy expensive now, so I think we do a lot more research before we, you know, shell out the $15 for a ticket or whatever.
And you're at least going to finish the $10 popcorn before you walk.
I sure am, and I'm going to get the free refill if I can.
But at home, you stream something else, you pop in another DVD, not a big loss.
Not at all.
All right, share your favorite bad movie of all time. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.